Hi. I'm definitely not hunching because now I feel criticized. Called out.
I'm sorry.
That's how it works.
It's not a bad thing.
Here we are being perceived.
Okay.
Live from New York, being perceived.
Okay, I'm going to count.
Please do.
Oh, sorry, did I do something?
No.
Is the door locked?
Yep.
Five, four, three, two.
Oh. I like the pose. You got me off guard with that. Welcome back to Metropolis. It is March 6th, 2024. I'm your host, Calden Rangder Datsenpa. Today, I am joined again by Drew Oyaje, the executive director of CUTV, publisher at The Breach. How are you doing today, Drew?
I'm doing great. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. Thank you for coming on. We got a nice agenda ahead of us for topics. We're going to be talking about Denis Coderre, stuff he's saying. We're going to be talking about carjackings in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
How to do it. And then we got Dune 2.
The full range of Denis. Spectrum of Quebec-based Denis people.
I wish the Valerie, like, I wish I could talk about the car theft stuff through a Denny lens, just so we could have like a Denny thing, but doesn't always work like that. So yeah, let's I have a clip here of former Montreal mayor Denis Coderre. He's sort of still in the public sphere, making comments here and there. Recently, he's sort of there's sort of talks about how he's eyeing the Liberal Party leadership seat.
Yeah, he's biding his time.
Yeah. But he hasn't, like, confirmed it yet, so I think he's just sort of, like,
Testing the waters,
massaging the masses, you know. Anyways, he was on Montreal Now with Aaron Rand on CJAD recently. He had some stuff to say about Bill 21. And I have a clip for us.
Let's roll it.
So, on that point then, Denis, If you were premier of Quebec, what would you do with Bill 21?
I would keep it because it's...
And you would keep the notwithstanding clause?
Yes, of course. And I would apply it if I need to.
So you would keep Bill 21. You're for Bill 21.
I'm for the fact that a prime minister and a national assembly has the right... And Doug Ford did it too.
I understand. I'm not disputing the right to use the notwithstanding clause. What I'm saying is... Let's say 2026, you're the premier of Quebec. What do you do with Bill 21?
You said yourself that there's a popular, and you know, since the 60s, when we had the Quiet Revolution, we decided to make a split between the church and the state.
Yes.
And Bill 21 is about that, and there's a consensus. And if it wasn't right, I mean, why the hell the CAQ won 90 seats at that selection?
All I'm saying is that if you were forming the next government, I would have the notwithstanding clause would run out. So would you renew it? Would you keep Bill 21 as is? Would you renew the notwithstanding clause for Bill 21?
I would keep it because I would focus more on the language issue than on the kind of society you want to live in as a secular versus a religious one.
All right.
So there we have it. Denis Coderre on Montreal Now talking about how he would keep Bill 21, renew the notwithstanding clause, and he would prefer to keep the debate about language rather than religious or secular society. What do you think about this, Drew?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think, first of all, before I start saying a lot of negative things about Denis Coderre, I just want to acknowledge that he's a talented politician. I mean, he knows what he's doing. He's acting with very intentionally, very strategically. The way he frames things, like later on in this interview, he says, I'm in the kitchen, I'm not in the lounge, you know, and it's this very evocative image, which of course is an absurd distinction, but it really sticks with you. You know, it's like
I'm in the basement, not the mudroom, you know.
it's like an earworm of political discourse. So I just wanted to sort of put that out up front.
Sure.
I think what he's doing here is he's currently testing the waters. No secret. He's testing the waters to potentially run for leadership of the Quebec Liberal Party. And I think that if he does do that, it'll be because he thinks he can become premier of Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So right now what he's doing is he's sort of teeing himself up, as they put it on one of the Luc Ferrandez, I think, referred to it as Capitaine Canada. And that Captain Canada has like shown up not accidentally, of course, in a bunch of articles about what he's been doing. He launched this movement, soi-disant, called No Merci. That's pretty much just, we don't want to have a referendum.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trying to take a position of saying we're better off economically within Canada. We can protect your language rights. But the problem that he would face if he sort of took that position, which I think has been popular in the past, has won majorities in the past,
mm-hmm.
remains to be seen whether it'll win majorities in the future.
The position being
pro-Canada, basically.
Sure.
The Liberal Party position, which is like, we're a strong Quebecois province within Canada, yeah. and that's that. And we don't want a referendum. We don't want this, like... Mm-hmm. big division happening, but we're still going to have our distinct policies and so on. Well, not really, because the Liberal Party has been extremely, austere,
of course,
in its economic policies, and you know has basically tried to gut the welfare state whenever it can.
I guess distinct from their perspective on like maybe like language issues or...
I think they're very much in favor. And this is getting to the point that I'm about to make, which is, or that Denis's making in this interview, which is that the appearance of being distinct is really the more important thing.
Mm-hmm.
What he's saying here is he's speaking to the Anglophone community, basically the like Anglophone base of mm-hmm. the Liberal Party, and saying... okay, if I'm going to be leader, you're going to have to tone it down. You're going to mm-hmm. have to stop playing into this culture war where it's, cultural diversity and the Anglos on one side and white Quebecers and Quebec identity on the other.
Sure.
Because that is a recipe, I think in his mind at least, for electoral defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't want to have to go. He doesn't want to have to fly that flag.
Of course.
I
guess he's sort of speaking to the West Island base, because right now the Liberal Party of Quebec, they're the fourth party in the legislature. Most mm-hmm. of that is all in the West Island. So I guess it's mm-hmm. speaking to them specifically, right? If you're talking about like that they need to tone it down, they need to kind of choose maybe another another program.
Yeah, and I think what the message that he's sending is, I don't have to do this. I don't have to do this. But if I'm going to do it, here's the condition. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's waiting for a signal back. He's throwing up a trial balloon, basically. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that, from my perspective, is that I think it runs the risk of consolidating the sort of ethnic identitarianism behind Bill 21. This mm-hmm. is effectively an Islamophobic, by another name, but feeding into and drawing on the sort of xenophobia and specifically Islamophobia. And the problem with Islamophobia in Quebec is that it has there's a death toll associated with it. Mm-hmm. Like it's not, we're playing with fire.
Right.
When we're encouraging that kind of thing. On the other hand, I could see trying to take it off the table as a hot button issue as a way to, I mean, I'm sure if he was premier, he would bring in on a purely symbolic level, mind you, different, like, he'd have some Muslim,
sure.
Member of the National Assembly, and they'd get some kind of symbolic job.
Right, because of like that kind of like organization, it would kind of take the heat off him for this sort of position he's taking now.
But that's the like hard limit on neoliberal politics. Sorry, not neoliberal. I promised I wouldn't use that word, and I've already failed.
Never, we'll put one down on the
but
neoliberal
what I meant to say
counter.
Is liberal, specifically liberal, with a capital L.
Yeah.
Politics is that you do the symbolic thing. You keep the status quo. Mm-hmm. You try to like you know, vaguely keep the social peace. As long as there's not like a strike, then you crush it.
Of course.
But you try to sort of keep this multicultural hyper-capitalism where everyone's exploited, but not at each other's throats too much. That's their MO. So I think the problem with that is that that's what got us here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got us to the mosque shooting. That's what got us to, you know, people facing like all kinds of just like racism against
this kind of liberal hyper-capitalism. You say is what kind of got us to this position?
Yeah, because when people's conditions of life deteriorate, mm-hmm. You know, they feel it. It's not an excuse for racism, but undeniably, the if you're not going to address the economic circumstances that are making you unhappy,
of course,
then you need an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the outlet? And Quebec politicians have been very happy to go to racism as the outlet.
Right, racism.
Xenophobia, and so
on. Right. It's like, let's say, like, oh, these economic conditions that we're in, this kind of, like, general, like, malaise, this economic downturn, and the way that people feel it, instead of being like, this is actually, like, this capitalist system, and this is because of the capitalist system, it's actually because of immigrants.
Yeah.
Right? I guess we see that with, like, the CAC, right? The CAC is great at that, where they're talking about how the housing crisis,
yeah,
because of immigrants. And
yeah,
I guess it's
classic. But, I mean, it goes back decades at this point too. Like, and when I first moved to Montreal in 2005, there was a really intense headline on the cover of the Journal de Montréal, which was at that point like one of the main sort of ways that people gauged news. Newspapers aren't really a thing anymore, but they were at that point. And they had this big bold text headline. It was like 55% of Quebecers say they're racist. And it was like, why are they doing this?
Yeah.
And we found out pretty quickly why they're doing it, because that's the kind of discourse that you need to whip up in order to distract from the fact that you're objectively eroding people's like living conditions, mm-hmm. and increasing their decreasing their quality of life and increasing their cost of living, mm-hmm. At the same time.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to address those things by, you know, I don't know, building social housing, raising wages, redistributing wealth, then you need to do something to distract people from the fact that you're not doing those
things. A culture
war. You need a culture war, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess you're expecting Denis Coderre at the helm of the Liberal Party to sort of continue that culture war, but like, I guess from a little bit of a different kind of...
No, I think he'll continue to ignore the culture war and like try to like have a superficial... unifying thing, and basically try to ignore the working class.
Yeah.
The base of the liberal party is middle class people who have sort of aspirations of and see their well-being, their economic well-being, as connected to the economy.
Sure.
So when corporations get higher profits, they benefit,
right?
Because they're whatever, they're lawyers, they're middle managers, they're doctors, whatever they are, they're gonna benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
And then because the media will play ball with that and not say, oh, well, what about the workers who are the majority?
Mm-hmm.
The whole liberal MO is to ignore that, is to keep those issues to the side,
mm-hmm.
And just out of the discourse, and make sure the main divisions are between. I mean, I think, yeah, the main division of Quebec for the last several decades has been sovereigntist federalist.
Mm-hmm.
And Denis Coderre wants to go right back to that because that is that's the liberal comfort zone,
mm-hmm.
For not talking about economic issues and just letting corporations run the show.
Right. I guess I'm kind of curious how, so if you think the liberals are sort of like doing this kind of, if like we're looking at this kind of culture war, and on one side it's like liberals who are doing this kind of like symbolic kind of gestures of, I guess like representation and sort of like gesturing towards this kind of sort of like cultural, like a multiculturalism, right? And they're like, mm-hmm. this is all very well and good and we support this, while ignoring the more material things. How do you think conservatives or right-wingers kind of like, how do they take the other side of that culture war?
Oh, by leaning into identity.
Right.
I mean, the sort of liberal identity is like, oh, yeah, we're the multicultural ones. Mm-hmm. Can't we all just get along? As long as we don't talk about anything substantial, we'll sort of throw a bone here and there on a purely symbolic plane. I mean, this is Justin Trudeau to a T, right? Make big promises and then dole out symbolic concessions. It's like, oh, we're not going to do the electoral reform that was the reason that a lot of people voted for us. But we will have a cabinet that's made up of 50% women,
mm-hmm.
Which is an undeniable gain. True. On the one hand,
of course,
but it's not going to, at the same time, rent went up by 3 times in Montreal. So
right.
There's limitations.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's going to be curious seeing, the direction of the Liberal Party from this sort of, bottom that they're at right now, right? They're kind of like a very historic low fourth party status. Be interesting to see if Cadell does sort of take the helm, where they're going to go with that. And also how he's going to, go up against Legault. Because Legault is also kind of doing poorly in the polling. And
yeah.
It's sort of interesting seeing him, seeing Denis Coderre take this sort of like, I'll say like positive, or not positive, but kind of like, he's not going against Bill 21, right? Because it's like, it's the sort of thing that's like immensely popular across the province, just not really in Montreal, of course, which is like naturally mm-hmm. the more diverse areas. It's kind of interesting seeing him try to weave in between.
I mean, what's been interesting to watch, so on the one hand, you have the rise of Quebec Solidaire, which is really the new piece.
Rise in the last 20 years, but like they sort of hit a plateau since 2018.
They made some minor gains the last time. They didn't like, they were like doubling their seat count several elections, and then they stopped doing that because of the Legault sort of juggernaut. But nonetheless, them being on the scene is new in terms of like viable liberal governments. So three election cycles. So basically, what's interesting about the Liberal Party is that you sort of see how flimsy their sort of ideological suppositions are. Like when they're out of power, they started having all this progressive rhetoric and talking about, redistributing wealth and like, lots of progressive policies. But, of course, no one really believed them, and no one's conditioned to talk in those terms about Quebec politics anyway, because we're still sort of beholden to the media, and there hasn't been the labor movements and so on are not powerful enough to assert a different fundamental division. And so now you have Coderre coming back, and I think what Quebec Solidaire very explicitly decided not to do was to try to transcend the old division of sovereigntist versus federalist.
Mm-hmm.
They've completely stayed in that framework because it was expedient in the short term to bring on Option Nationale, which is another sort of sovereigntist. Basically, it was the same policies as Quebec Solidaire plus cultural nationalism.
Right.
And so they were able to sort of bring that activist base in, and as a result, make the leap to winning some seats in Quebec City.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big gain they got from that. But now they're firmly stuck in a sovereignty first position, which means it's going to be very, very difficult to get a majority, because there's already 1.5 other sovereigntist parties that they're always going to be competing with. True. One of which is now, has the potential to win a majority if there's an election. Yeah.
They went from like what, 2-3 seats. Yeah. And now they're like really ahead in the polls. The PQ led by Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon.
So basically we had this moment where it looked like actual economic progressivism could be on the agenda, but then there's a real attempt on by everybody to revert, just because it's like, it's easy, it's comfortable, it's what we know. We're not used to like, having to like create a new coalition and new ways of talking about politics is hard. So everybody, sort of including Quebec Solidaire, I think, just reverted to talking about the old way that we were used to for like several decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're teeing ourselves up for another,
more the same
referendum on referendum,
mm-hmm.
like a referendum on whether we'll have a referendum. That's basically the political divide now. And of course, redistributive policies are what are the first at the chopping block when that's the main division.
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting seeing how that kind of comes up again.
But Coderre is a talented politician, and I think he's trying to put the pieces in place. He clearly doesn't know if they're quite there yet, and he doesn't want to. He's also kind of daring people,
yeah,
you know, to defy him and say and make a big fuss about this, mm-hmm, because this is a trial balloon. If people do make a big fuss about this, then no, it's important to like that a Liberal government overturn, you know, Bill 21, yeah, and stop using the notwithstanding clause, which is such an absurd thing. Anyway, wouldn't have to get into that, but yeah, if you are going to make a fuss about it, well, I'll just back off. So he's sort mm-hmm. of he's playing chicken with the sort of culture warriors.
Yeah, I should have known it was good. I mean,
culture warriors. I don't mean that in, you know, obviously there's something at stake there in that culture war.
Yes, of course.
In the sense that, you know, we're talking about a law that is designed to marginalize
non-Christians,
immigrants, yeah, and non-Christians. Yeah, course, non-Christians, yeah, yeah, in general. Yeah.
The people who don't like the Christians who don't really have any kind of like sort of like religious like attire or like,
yeah, exactly,
that they wear on the regular, and it sort of affects like Sikhs, Muslims.
Well, Jews. As Christians, it's like, okay, if you wear a giant cross, then you're not allowed. Like, who does that?
Yeah, no,
like,
does that.
But you're allowed, even if you're a public employee, you're allowed to wear also, like a little one, which is just as like obvious a religious display. I mean, let's be clear here. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's an absurd double standard.
Yeah, who doesn't think it's a religious display? It's like, oh, nice letter T, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there is also that gigantic cross in the National Assembly that the Duplessis government put up. But that's, of course, that's not the church and state. That's,
yeah, and schools named Saint-Enfant-Jésus, and yeah. We could go on and on. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Something else I was going to say. Anyways, yeah, I think it'll be interesting seeing where Denis Coderre goes with that. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, there's something I want to say, but it's gone now. Let's move on to the topic.
Mm-hmm.
It'll
come back after the second Denis.
Yeah. That's it. The other Denis will summon it. So, Drew, you drive, right?
I do.
You ever had a car stolen?
I confess that I have not had a car stolen.
You ever stole a car? On what date?
Put me on the spot here, Golden. No, I have not stolen a car.
All right. Well, car thefts are up in Canada. I'm learning this recently.
Yeah, it's a big thing.
Yeah. Just at the beginning of February, there was an auto theft summit in Ottawa. It was sort of like a coalition of a bunch of different police forces across the country, insurance companies, because obviously they're the ones who have to like, now they're like payouts for car theft is going up, and insurance never likes paying out people. So they're quick on the ball with trying to organize something. No fun for them. They're quick on the ball trying to organize something. So at this auto theft summit, it was insurance companies, police boards across the country, as well as kind of border security services agency. And they're all sort of talking about this.
Our favorite coalition.
I know. I'm not happy that these people are meeting, but like, this is interesting, I guess. I mean, we'll get into this. But essentially, car thefts are up. The federal government announced some extra money to Montreal. Valerie Plante is saying that, we'll get to that actually. Valerie Plante is saying some stuff to car thieves directly. But first, let's...
Let me now turn to the car thieves in the audience.
Yeah, who's a car thief here? Let's just watch the clip. Yeah, we have a clip from CBC News.
Investigation takes us to West Africa, to car lots and gas stations in the Nigerian city of Lagos.
When did this one came to Nigeria?
It came in December 4th.
4th of December, 2 months ago?
Yes.
Our undercover researchers check vehicle identification numbers, run them through a website that lets you search for cars reported stolen, and we find many. This Honda is both made in and boosted from Canada. Check out the sticker from a dealership in Montreal. And can there be any doubt about this Lexus still wearing its Ontario license plate? A quick search confirms the crime. Back home, it hits home for people like Natalie Cara.
Take me through it. Like, when did all of this happen?
That was a Thursday night, overnight. Both my son and I were sleeping.
We're watching her 2020 Lexus being stolen from her driveway.
Every day you can read somebody somewhere got their car stolen. And sometimes you hear like 3 or 4 cars a night. And I'm like, this is not a joke what's happening. How come it's so easy?
Here's how easy. Natalie's car is stolen 2 more times after that.
All right. Well, I'm glad I don't have a Lexus that gets stolen 3 times, I have to say.
I was thinking about buying a Lexus.
That would be somewhat stressful.
I was thinking about buying a used Lexus, but no longer. If we go to the next slide immediately. Yeah, so here we have it. Valerie Plante, Montreal car thieves, you will be arrested. Very direct. This is in Cult Montreal. This is published February 22nd, 2024. Montreal Mayor Valerie Plante has issued a statement following the announcement of additional funding from the Government of Canada to fight car theft and the dismantling of a criminal car theft network in Montreal. The week prior to this announcement, Valerie Plante, there was a story about police seizing 53 stolen cars at the Port of Montreal. And I guess through all these pieces, through that clip we saw in CBC News, I guess the picture is essentially like cars are being stolen at much higher rates. Insurance companies are having to pay these people out. These cars are ending up in places like West Africa, places like in the video we saw in like Lagos, Nigeria. Hilariously, cars from Longueuil are ending up there, which is like, that's like Longueuil on the map.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess you have here a Valerie Plante sort of like, I guess...
Who says Quebec doesn't have cultural influence around the world?
Yeah, no, literally. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, we're everywhere. We got Kitchener, we got stolen cars.
Our CRVs can be found in every West African state. Yeah.
I think there's an interesting... I guess when I hear this kind of news, there's this... I think about the sort of rise in car prices, used car prices that's been happening over the last few years. That's usually something that people say, economists usually say, like whenever like used car prices start going up, that's usually like a sign of an economic downturn coming up. I think the car prices have been going up also because of supply chain issues and the sort of like, I guess the efficiency of those have been sort of put to the test. So the kind of the wait lists are long. And usually when wait lists are long for buying new cars, people start buying older cars, used cars. And that's why those car values go up. But I mean, across the board, car values have been going up. And I think it's sort of like, I think of it as a sort of parallel to like the housing crisis, right? Mm-hmm. We have this thing where like the price of property and homes is going up and then people are treating it like an asset. I think in a similar sense, because cars, of course, as like there are these big complicated machines, like earlier in the video, we didn't see a clip, but they're talking, they're these like big rolling computers right nowadays.
Yeah.
Those are incredibly valuable. And especially at a time when, because of that value, people are sort of locked out of a certain car market. There's a need for them still, you know, they're locked out of this kind of like the need for these vehicles because of the prices, but the need is still there. And then these thefts start happening. And it does seem like these thefts are sort of organized, right? It's sort of people who are who want to get these cars to like Lagos, Nigeria, which is like one of the fastest growing cities in the world. I think it's like must be like top like 5 most populous places. Mm-hmm. Nigeria's a growing economy. Clearly a need for cars there. The prices are too high, so whatever networks are organizing to get these cars over there.
I mean, I think when you have rising inequality and rising living costs, then you're going to get economic redistribution one way or another. But
yeah, exactly.
But crime is like the least efficient method of economic redistribution because it gets redistributed to a very small number of people who are willing to like transgress social norms and tear up the social fabric.
Yeah.
And then organized crime, who are just like the worst people. Not the worst people, but they're up there with some of the pharma CEOs and stuff.
Nice, that's the ranking.
Mafia bosses, pharmacy. I don't know. There's a little different ways you could look at it, but in any case, they they take their cut, their 30% or whatever it is to pay off the port workers and the customs agents. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, it's easy to be pretty cynical about this stuff, you know, like they're going to pay the feds are going to pay the Montreal police to like, you know, do some enforcement around this. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody who's ever reported a theft knows that the police don't do anything when you report a theft.
It should have happened.
And so
up after.
And so they're, Yeah, they're gonna do nothing faster. Like, what are they gonna do? You know,
yeah.
Three times zero is still zero.
Yeah.
and it's like, you know, I don't want to like test our you know, libel lawsuit representation here, but when you hear about, oh, they found 53 cars in the port, it's like, okay, how did they find those 53 cars? Mm-hmm. Was it because there was a diligent investigation by, you know, Detective, Saint-Hubert or whatever?
Yeah,
or was it, you know, who was hitting the streets and, you know, picking up cigarette butts and doing DNA tests, you know, CSI Montreal style? Mm-hmm. Or was it because... you know, somebody knows exactly where those cars are and knows exactly who they are and says, okay, well, we gotta, for us to keep our image up, you know, we're going to have to, be able to show something. We're going to have to be able to like, show some progress here. So can you, you're stealing hundreds of cars, but can you give up a few containers so that we can like have something to put on the evening news?
Give some crumbs.
The heat is on a little too high. We just need to take the heat off us and make it look like we're doing our job.
Mm-hmm.
That's the more cynical version. I'm not saying that's what happened, but
sure, that's a cynical take.
There's a large body of past experience with Montreal's police specifically,
mm-hmm.
That would lead us to speculate in that direction, shall we say. Was there some point in the recent past when that kind of corruption and payoffs and, you know, being complicity with organized crime suddenly stopped being the case and they started being a clean, you know, non-corrupt police force? It's possible. It's possible that point happened at some point.
Can we point to it?
Charbonneau Commission would be an opportune moment to sort of stick that pin in the timeline.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what goes on. I haven't done an in-depth investigation. I can only speculate.
Of course.
So it's one or the other.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think which do we think is more plausible? The detective Saint-Hubert, diligently, swabbing windshield wipers
back alleys. You know, just talking to people.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Shaking people down.
Yeah.
Where's my Lexus?
Oh God.
Yeah. I think there's one of the other sides to this is, of course, this kind of like extra money going to these police forces. I think someone in the Global News article, can the auto theft summit put the brakes on rising crime? There's optimism. There's someone from the, I think it's literally like this car theft, like this international car theft, like awareness sort of organization that was talking about like,
a noble cause, car theft awareness.
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh my God, that's up there, I guess. He was sort of talking about how he's very optimistic about this sort of summit because he's never seen this kind of level of like inter-organizational meeting communication, right? This like, and to me, there's like, I don't like that. To me, I don't like that because here you have these historically either corrupt, violent organizations trying to find more ways to get money, right? Trying to find more ways to get money, more ways to get public support. And of course, not to say that like car thefts shouldn't be stopped, of course. It's not to say that car thefts shouldn't be... it's not to say these car thieves should not be arrested or anything like that, but it's like none of these are, I find none of the solutions that are being put forward are anything near close to preventative, right? It's like we're saying, the cops show up after it's done and they show up after the cars have been sort of like stolen. It's, their sort of job is like to do this kind of half-assed job of like finding the cars or sort of like being able to paint some kind of timelines like, oh, they're in Nigeria now and then what do we do about it? Anyways, people were talking about giving Canada border security more money, more resources. And I think if it does end up in less cars being stolen, I think good. But then now you hear you have these organizations that are already, for the most part, bloated, filled with cash, now with even more cash and even more kind of like government support. And also now they're no longer these like individual, they're not acting like individual cells across the country in the term of like, in terms of like police departments, but now they're sort of like all like they have these lines of communication with each other. Not to say that they didn't have that already, but it's like those bonds are like strengthening, and it seems like a coalition is sort of forming to find my Lexus.
Yeah. I mean, what we can say for sure is that they need to be seen to be doing something.
Yes.
What we can say might be the case is that they need to actually do something.
Yeah.
So somewhere between those, somewhere in that gray area lies what's actually happening. I think it is important to note that, like, you know, when people lose faith in the society they live in and they sort of, you know, they lose their sense of safety and they lose faith that the institutions around them are actually doing anything to help them. That doesn't usually help the cause of the left, redistribution of greater social solidarity. It leads people to recoil. And I think what Valerie Plante's doing here is trying to get ahead of, you know, Denis Quader's old outfit, you know, Ensemble, who of course is going to press on this issue because this is the perfect middle, you know, people who can spend $30,000 on a car can also spend, you know, $1,000 on an electoral donation,
of course,
and are much more likely to vote. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to win an election, you need those people on your side. They're going to be the people absent a massive, you know, organizing push at the level of the working class. That's going to be who is going to decide an election on the island of Montreal. And so you need those people.
I think even on like a larger scale now, like if we think about the rise of like the auto dealership, right? Because I think these are like, to me, I'm always thinking about like these like the kind of power they have, right? Because like I think to me, auto dealerships are sort of represent this sort of privatization. Three times charm. Privatization of this sort of like what used to be like a public transport system right across the country with trains was sort of the main thing. This kind of like thing that was for the most part held in common, and like highways and car dealerships were the sort of way to sort of, I guess, disseminate that kind of money and power that used to be that whatever in a train ticket and like people riding together, and it sort of put into this sort of upper strata of that society where people can now afford their own cars, right? I mean, it's like there's like this whole thing about like I guess like personal freedom that people got from it, but
it's a crucial driver of like capitalist subjectivity. I mean,
especially in North America,
it's a status symbol. It creates this like bubble of isolation around you that makes you feel separate from everyone else.
That's why I want a convertible.
Exactly.
I want a convertible
for, so you can feel political reasons. You can commune.
Yes.
Commune with the populace.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That sounds
like I'm not in my prison cell.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah. I have a sunroof. I'll commune with the populace that way. Yeah. No, but seriously, I mean, I think if you're taking the train to work, if you're taking a trolley, if you're walking even,
you have a whole different relationship to society.
You're in a commons. Yeah. You're in the same situation, and you're visually and physically, spatially orienting and identifying with the people around you. Mm-hmm. There's a community there.
Yeah.
But if you're in a car, it's just like everybody else is an a-hole that you know is cutting you off or tailgating you or whatever they're doing, you know?
In my day-to-day life, I get the most upset when I'm in my car. It's like, I just notice that about myself. And it's like, I don't think it's like, I'm working on it, but I think there's something about that environment that really causes that, as you're saying. But I think even going back to this thing about like...
yeah, and that creates that subjectivity, that orientation toward everybody else that is fundamentally right-wing.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, because we're talking about like, you were talking about the supporters, right, that... of Denis Coderre's, that let's say Valerie Plante is trying to like sort of like trying to steal or trying to secure their support by saying this kind of stuff. I think it's also important to note it's not just the
Her supporters too. I mean, that's
her thing is the green cars, right? The kind of like the hybrids or the.
But that, you know, Projet Montréal has been actively going after that like middle class vote. I mean, that's their,
of course.
Even if that's not where they started, that's where they ended up.
True.
And I think it goes back to what we were saying about Quebec politics. It's just like, is it because it's impossible to mobilize like people, like more working class people who are actually like paying rent and, you know, taking public transit? they're just a lot harder to mobilize, and we don't know how to do that. We know, you know, there's a whole bunch of political consultants and operatives who know how to reach, you know, people who own CRVs. Mm-hmm. And
the most stolen vehicle in Quebec.
The most stolen by far, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, it's like you have Valérie Plante sort of making this sort of effort. But I think it's also important to know how Denis Coderre has the support, not of just like drivers, but also of dealerships. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times municipal governments have almost a lot of control over, like, let's say the daily life of a driver, right? Yeah. Like parking tickets and sort of like roadways and stuff like that. And that's why dealerships, for the most part, will kind of like put their back behind someone. Dealerships were huge funders and sort of behind the financial forces of Godel's party. And to me, that's what I think about when I hear about this kind of stuff. And I think about this sort of, like, if we think about that coalition of, like, dealerships and the sort of force that the... Like, we think of them as this kind of organized kind of capital force. They're going to be putting their money behind Coderre and then potentially maybe Valérie Plante for these kinds of statements. Mm-hmm. Those are the lines I'm thinking of.
Yeah, that's another aspect of the economic and political engine of car production.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also something that's like an asset that's extremely expensive, but also depreciates very quickly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. As soon as you drive it off the lot.
Yeah. Then, you've lost, like, however many thousands of dollars in value. Yeah. But
they're not investments.
not in the least. But because it's something that depreciates and has to be produced over and over again, it's a great mechanism for keeping, for the sort of capillary action of capital, keeping it circulating through industry.
Keeping it well-oiled,
keeping the machine well-oiled, as it were, yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I just like a dumb car. I think cars have too much gadgets in them now. Mm-hmm. We see in the video, that video we showed initially, there's like, I think the CBC reporter was in LA talking to like people who are like hackers, and they're just sort of opening cars up with like just these little, mm-hmm. like, I don't know, like gizmos, right? And I think, I mean, that sort of adds, I bring that up because we're talking about this thing about having this asset that is a car that is sort of like always in production, right? And mm-hmm. sort of because of that, because you always want to sell a new car every year and every few, like, whatever, like, cycles, you always want to, like, try to, like, what's the value add to this, right? Mm-hmm. What's, like, how do we do more for the consumer of this? And at the point it's at now, I mean, cars are so complicated. Like, I think this is even beyond just, like, a little, like, Montreal thing. I think there's something to the, I guess, a consumer kind of thing.
No, there was a study the other day, I saw it go by. It was, like, the number of pieces involved in, like, fixing a car in a fender bender, used to be like, I don't know, 20 or something. And now it's like 120.
Yeah, which is...
And so it's like the cost of, you know, dealing with like a minor accident is like thousands of dollars higher.
Yeah. And then that's more money of course, if you're like with the dealership gets that money for the fixes, right? Then the money goes down for the whole supply chain that has to supply that kind of thing.
And all this like absurd level of digitalization, which like they have like BMWs now, like, doing what Tesla does, which is like you pay like $30 a month to activate your seat warmers or whatever. So it's like they're trying to like squeeze all the revenue out. But of course, like if we were in a rational society, we would have simple, durable cars that have interchangeable parts are heavily commodified. So it's easy to get them and replace them and like, you just go to a machine shop,
they can just replace the part there.
Yeah, you keep it going for ages, but now it's like, oh, you don't have the like V7S 523 chip.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, this is just the 524. That's all we have.
So can I drive without it? Like, no, sorry, your car's kind of
your car's not going to work anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, sure, your car's kind of bricked because of that. Yeah. No, it's sort of like I think of it the same along the same lines as like, I mean, you see it less because like people are pushing against it, but like the sort of like proprietary stuff that like tech companies do, right? Where it's like Apple, right? Like you need to use like Apple cables. You want to fix your phone, you got to bring to it like an Apple dealership. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And people say that about Tesla, right? I mean, Tesla sort of represents a combination of these two kind of worlds of like the tech world, because Tesla's more of a tech company than anything. There's like completely a tech company that whose stock value is completely overblown, sort of combining forces with the auto world. Yeah. Not to say that the auto world is friendly with them, but there's this clear kind of like bridge there being built. Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to my dad who before he passed would buy like a used 79 Toyota pickup truck.
I love that.
Drive it until it literally fell apart. And then traded in as a parts car for another 79 Toyota.
That's the life.
He wouldn't go past 1980. That's, I think he finally broke down and got a 1980 in like, you know, the late 90s. That was his jam. Because he felt like he knew how to fix them. He knew what the deal was. Their durables all get out. And you don't want to deal with like chips and plugging it into computers and all this stuff. This is in the 90s, right? I mean, the complexity that's been added, that layered on since then is just absurd.
Yeah, you need to be like a computer scientist now to deal with some cars. Yeah, that's why I bought, like, I used to have this old like Jeep Cherokee. Like, I think if we're talking about like what my like year deadline is, my cutoff, it's been 2003. Every car I've bought has been either like, my first one was like 98, 2001, 2003. Was a Jeep Cherokee, Toyota Corolla, a Camry, and they're all super easy to work on. I worked on them myself.
Yeah,
saves money, but then it's like companies don't want you doing that, right? Because it's like that you're sort of like you get to exist outside of sort of their income flows.
Want you trading in your windshield when your heads up display starts having a pixel malfunction or something. Yeah,
unbelievable. Speaking of machines, the future, robots.
Speaking of 5,000 years after we have eliminated the thinking machines.
Speaking of the Butlerian jihad.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry, now we're getting into, we have to backtrack and explain things to people.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, that's what the show is about. It's about explaining things. A new movie came out by the name of Dune 2.
Indeed it did.
Electric Boogaloo. No, that's not what it's called. It's just called Dune 2. The sequel to Dune came out recently by Denis Villeneuve, Quebecois filmmaking legend. Really sort of on an incredible run of films. They have not been... I think the last seven have been...
He's a special director.
Yeah. Really incredibly talented. And so like, you might be wondering, like, what does this have to do with, like, politics?
Mm-hmm. You might be wondering that,
dear listener.
As they say in the meme groups, Dune is not political.
Dune is not political, of course. Dune is not political. Dune is political. Let's go to the next slide.
Indeed. What do we got here?
Oh, yeah. All right. So before we play this, so here we have... Dune 2 came out. Critics are loving it. People are loving it.
Highest rated on Rotten Tomatoes ever.
Ever?
I think so.
I mean, I don't like Rotten Tomatoes too much. I feel like I always see like a 99% on that.
This is like 99.5.
Whoa. Really, really inching the decimal points. Yeah. I mean, that is to say that people have been enjoying it. I enjoyed it. I watched it. I liked it a lot better than the first one. Honestly, I wasn't really a fan of the first one. I'll be honest. But we can get into that later. So here we have Denis Villeneuve. He made sure to... they had the premiere for Dune 2 in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have a little interview with him where he talks about, I guess, the Montreal influence on the film, or his perspective, and I guess how he connects his sort of upbringing and the things he grew up with, his directing of this film. Let's watch this clip.
Yeah.
Here. What is it about Dune that, like, you're going to spend a decade of your life on this?
Yeah. It's truly an obsession. There's something in that book that speak deeply to my roots. The idea of a young man that finds home and peace in another culture, and the idea of an exploration of the danger of blending politics and religion together, and the study of culture in relationship with their ecosystems. It's all topics, things that I was fascinated with when I was a kid. And that still those themes stayed alive in me. Why I still love the book like that, it's mysterious. But every time I open the book, I have the same pure joy. The reality, when I wrote the screenplay 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and the actuality changed. We are in difficult times right now, but it is a movie about a conflict and the pressure of politics and religion, and it's like what Frank Herbert wrote the book inspired by the main currents of the 20th century. It made projection in the future, and sadly, it feels more relevant than it used to be in the 60s. So that's I have.
The film is a statement about Gaza. Just say it, Denis.
Yeah. Come on, Denis. Say it. He's always in the Middle East. It's kind of waiting for him to say that himself. I mean, called the fucking.
Yeah, he seems to really have a connection to the Middle East.
Yeah.
Referring, of course, to Ansandi, which is his sort of breakout.
Yeah, I mean, even in success. I can't remember the name. Is the first feature that sort of won the Ernesto God Prize when it came out. It was also in the desert. He sort of loves the desert.
Mm-hmm.
I think he talks about it being this place of like contemplation, and it's like I get it. But before we get into that,
yeah, absolutely.
He talks about the book. So this movie is adapted from the book, the first book by Frank Herbert called Dune in the Dune series. There's a lot of those books. Tell us about the books, Drew. I know you're a fan. I know, and also. You grew up in the same town, was it?
Yeah, I grew up a few miles away from Frank Herbert, mm-hmm. Who had like a house in Port Townsend where he this is in Washington State where he was experimenting with like green energy and solar panels and all kinds of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and he would spend a lot of time on the Quileute Reservation, which is like a indigenous nation on the Pacific coast there. And I also spent some time there. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. How do you feel that influence when you're watching the movie or reading the books?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Daniel Immerwahr, who's a really interesting sort of, you know, anti-imperialist writer, author, academic, has done some really interesting writing about this. So if you want to go down that rabbit hole, I definitely recommend his stuff.
What's his name again?
Daniel Immerwahr.
Daniel Immerwahr.
Var is a W, and then W-A-H-R, I think.
I'm sure if you just do your best at typing Daniel Immerwahr, Dune, something will come up.
Google will figure it out for you.
The machine will help you.
The thinking machine. Dune, I feel like this is where we do a time lapse, and it's like 3 hours later, and I'm still explaining. but Dune takes place 10,000 years in the future, and it's on this alien planet. And I think what I think is really remarkable about the book itself is that Frank Herbert creates this totally strange but somehow plausible ecology. So he creates, you know, it's a desert planet. There are these sandworms that are around and very dangerous, and they're gigantic, and they'll just like swallow you up basically if you walk out in the desert, open desert. But they have a connection, mysterious connection to the spice, which is turned, as it turns out, part of the worm's sort of life cycle.
Mm-hmm. But also used by for space travel.
Which also has these hallucinatory effects and life extending effects, and so becomes this like precious substance all throughout the universe, and is the thing that enables space travel in the absence of the AI machines, which humanity has like completely destroyed like 5,000 years before because they were running amok.
And I think the spice to me is sort of like if the tar sand, if you could get high off the tar sands, that's sort of like what it is to me.
Yeah. If you could snort the tar sand, pretty much.
Yeah, would not recommend.
Yeah, not an endorsement.
Yeah, please. The car theft stuff, that's something else, but do not snort tar sands.
Excuse me. So he's created this whole universe, and then and then layered on top of that ecology are these sort of people who are these sort of outcast wanderer types who have been expelled from different planets and have tried to find a homeland and end up on this desert planet because it's the only place they can live and have to make peace. I have to like find a way to coexist in this like extremely hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this, and he goes into extreme detail about the sort of culture that develops in that context, and the relationship to the sandworms and the spice and the relationship to the desert and the desert planet and how like some people want to transform it. Some people, it turns out, want to keep it. Anyway, there's all these really interesting tensions that sort of come up and it really does echo, I think, his, sort of understanding of his life on the Pacific coast, because his life was riven with contradictions. He was he worked for a logging company. This is the author of Dune. Worked for a logging company, and then his like good friend, who's this Quileute guy, wrote a book just excoriating the logging industry and how it had would dry up the forest ecology, which is obviously like these rich rainforests.
Mm-hmm.
On the Pacific coast. And so Frank Herbert was like dealing with this inner contradiction while he's writing this book. So it's I think those contradictions make it very rich. Mm-hmm. It's also a sort of a rebuke of the white of a sort of a white savior narrative. And some people say that it reinscribes the white savior narrative. Some people say it successfully undermines it. I'll leave that to the audience to decide. But Denis Villeneuve, in any case, I don't think it's giving away too many spoilers to say that he is leaning into that part, that aspect of the book, as a central theme.
The white savior, or this sort of, I guess this, not I guess in the sense of
the critique of the white savior.
Of course, the critique of the white savior, specifically like this white savior through like this religious kind of lens and the way they kind of summon that, right? Yeah. I mean,
and the manipulation based on stories and different things like that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's my Dune take. But let's talk about Denis Villeneuve.
That's exactly what I was leading
also,
into.
Also, shout out also to Tanya LaPointe, who's married to Denis Villeneuve and also a producer on Dune and a journalist, longtime journalist with Radio Canada and a documentary filmmaker who made a film called 50-50 about gender equality.
Shout out, Tanya. Great job. Great job on all of that. And also being married to Denis Villeneuve. I'm just kidding. Let's go to our next slide. I think we have here we have. So yeah, if we want to get into Denis Villeneuve's sort of how he posits his Quebecois influences towards this film. Of course, I am of the belief the author is dead. Authorial intentions to me are sort of I'll consider them. But of course, for this show,
you take a more Foucauldian sort of approach to the whole thing.
Is that what he? I don't know. Is that what he does?
I mean, I won't get into the theory about the author.
I guess I do.
The author doesn't really exist, I think, is the short version, but yeah.
Yeah. Whatever that Foucault guy says, I agree with. So here we have an article in Cult Montreal. Mm-hmm. Denis Villeneuve was on the cover of it. People are celebrating this big win for Montreal. People who go to UQAM are like, yo, like me and Denis Villeneuve were like the same mind, of the same mind in the same halls.
We sat in the same lecture hall in Judith Jasmin or whatever.
We're eating Doritos at the same spot in the cafeteria. His genius is my genius.
Yeah, soak it up.
In this article by Justin Smith for Cult Montreal, it's titled Denis Villeneuve's Quiet Revolution in Dune, Part 2. We spoke with the Montreal filmmaker about drawing inspiration from the desert and from a chapter of Quebec history that continues to resonate. Next slide, please. All right, so here we have. Yes,
this is a mouthful.
Yeah. No, this is my job now.
All right.
So here we have an excerpt from the article. This is Denis Villeneuve responding to Justine's question about his sort of background and how it sort of takes. How he connects it to the film. Denis Villeneuve. I was born in 1967 when Quebec had just separated from the church, and the intellectuals of the province were working to separate church and state. Before that, the church had a hold on politics in Quebec that was very unhealthy. Artists and young politicians with the Refus Global and what follows decided to break with the church and create a secular state. That idea helped me in my adaptation of and my approach to the people of this world in Dune, which is to say, I didn't want them to be homogenous, that they'd have different sets of beliefs, different processes of thought, and that we have a youth movement that puts into question established dogmas that are still being embraced by an older generation. I had the idea that Chani, one of the characters of the film played by Zendaya, was a reaction against the alienation of this older generation and the religion of her elders, and that maybe it's a little bit like that generation in Quebec who were reacting against their parents. So I guess what Denis is trying to say here is the Fremen in Dune are Quebecois, I guess, to him. I mean, maybe that's a simplification.
That is the conclusion of a lot of people on Twitter who are making horrible fun of Denis Villeneuve for saying this.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I see it. I see. Like, I understand the sort of the political threads he's drawing upon for this film.
I mean, as a filmmaker, I think if you're going to really get into material, you have to find a ways to relate it to your own life. I think that's what he's talking about here. Like, you're finding ways to like, okay, I have this lived, a deeper lived experience of what it's like to live in a society that's, casting off the reins of organized religion, which is like a deeply oppressive force in Quebec society.
It's still, I mean, that kind of legacy is so often called upon still, right? It's like so deeply. I mean, even just in that interview we saw, like, Denis Coderre, I'm going to mix them up. Denis Coderre was talking about, like, you know, it was like the Quiet Revolution. He's trying to draw upon that history. He's talking about Bill 21, which I'd say is still like a sort of remnant of that kind of like mindset, right? To like remove church and state. Of course, at this point, it's, I would say it's sort of a mutated into a sort of Baron Harkonnen sort of figure, but it's the history is there. The history is there.
Yeah.
You're gonna say.
No, I think that's it. I mean, I'm curious what you think of this excerpt. I mean, I've been talking to, for the last. No, this morning and this afternoon, I was talking to some filmmaker friends just about the sort of milieu that created Danny Villeneuve. So I want to talk about that, but let's finish up with this.
Yeah, actually, that's really interesting. Really interesting to talk about that. But I guess, I mean, just to say, I sort of, like we're saying, right? Like any kind of filmmaker, any kind of artist has to kind of draw upon their experiences. And I guess I see what Denny here is drawing upon when he's talking about, like, because like religion has a huge role in this film. I think this film is much more sort of religious, plays a lot more with the ideas of like prophecy and how people sort of like use that for these kind of, not necessarily nefarious things, but like they use it in to sort of advance this kind of war, right? They use it to sort of like almost like capture people completely. Like I think one of the characters, this is like maybe a little spoiler, but one of the characters in the last film I find was much more level-headed. In this one, much more of a sort of like religious zealot of sorts, sort of completely enamored by this
really
idea.
Yeah, they really played up that aspect of him.
Yeah. I see a lot of funny memes about him too.
You don't believe, but I believe.
Yeah. We are the believers. So I guess I'm kind of hungry for a harder connection that Denis wants to make with this, because I find he's very careful when he's like in that interview where he's like, you know, we live in difficult times, but like, you know, it's like. We gotta believe, or whatever. I can't remember what he was saying specifically.
I mean, if I had a critique of Dune 2, and again, trying to avoid spoilers, but it's to say that like it does sort of feel like an anti-colonial critique, sort of processed by two sensitive white guys, you know, like because that's who wrote the script, right?
Of
like,
course,
it's John Spates and Denis Villeneuve. And I think that you lose some depth there, but you do. I think what you lose in depth, you might gain in popular resonance if the box office is any indication. In the sense that you have, you know, these characters. I mean, I feel like I recognize these characters, a lot of them, in terms of like
the archetype.
The archetype of like the colonial critique, the true believer, like all these different things are sort of playing out, and it's powerful to have your sort of little fragments of your lived experience sort of pulled out and made very bright on the big screen. I think there's real power to that. I'm curious what kind of cultural effect it has. I mean, clearly Villeneuve is very upset about what's happening in Gaza right now. And you know,
you see clearly.
I mean, from the clip.
I think it could have been clearer.
Clearly, he's also suppressing it because he's a Hollywood director. Yeah. So he's saying everything he can say without, you know, potentially upsetting. You know, Hollywood is all in for team IDF.
There's a list.
there's a list circulating. There are many lists circulating. Yeah. No, it's horrifying. But I think within that context, I mean, I think he knows he's not going to that's not the stand he's going to take right now. But on the other hand, he wants to hint at it as much as he can. That's my sense anyway.
I think that kind of anti-colonial stuff is like really interesting in the film. I think it's like incredible. Like he was saying himself, right? It's incredibly relevant nowadays, despite like this kind of like gap. And I think that kind of, I guess, has a lot to do with Herbert's sort of like world that he's able to draw upon these like real processes, right? I think before you're talking about this sort of interesting, the culture stuff, right? There's this kind of like really interesting anthropological world in the film. But it's not just like, I think what sets Dune apart from other sci-fi is it's not just like a fantastical world where it's just purely like there's like a material kind of basis for like the culture, right? There's I think that's what like people say like communist leftist love Dune because it's like in comparison to Star Wars, this has like real like you see this kind of like I'm saying, right? Replace spice with oil and it's like still the same processes, right? Mm-hmm. You have this kind of like rest of native population who are sort of around this resource that this colonial force is really trying to get in with their like machines, mm-hmm. their extractive tools, and they need to either suppress them or kind of convert them to the cause. And this is really interesting dynamic at play.
And what Daniel Immerwahr really pulls out is how Frank Herbert himself was a conflicted colonialist. Yes. I mean, he wanted to be a colonialist, yeah. basically. I mean, like, he was made no bones about it. He wanted to, like, go and be, like, you know, the sort of superior colonizer, basically, mm-hmm. and, like, tell people how to do things and how to develop their agriculture and stuff, which is just, like, disastrous. And it was disastrous. His mm-hmm. actual lived experience with that was, you know, didn't work. It went badly. but you can tell he understands that desire from the inside, but on the other hand, he's has developed this criticism through his friendship with these indigenous people and so on. So it's I think that's what makes it, or in addition to what you said, which is, you know, the sort of material basis and the ecological, cultural, the eco-cultural sort mm-hmm. of milieu that he like vividly creates, mm-hmm. That the sort of contradictions and that the lived agony of those of living, you know, being a U.S. citizen really, mm-hmm. are at the forefront there as well. So and you know, timeless within our century, certainly.
Of course. So we're talking about the kind of forces that sort of shaped Herbert and mm-hmm. his writing of Dune. Let's talk about the forces that shaped Villeneuve and I guess the road that he took to this movie.
My compliments on the segue.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Denis Villeneuve also was shaped by social forces, and I think I've been sort of going into it for an article that I'm writing for The Breach right now. It's fascinating, sort of what, you know, how do you, you know, I guess by contrast, if you look at the big sort of auteur people, you know, auteur filmmakers who are at the top of the box office, you have, you know, basically Christopher Nolan and maybe Greta Gerwig, mm-hmm. Who are up there. Otherwise, if you look at the like top grossing box office stuff, it's like I don't know, Avengers 15,
sure.
Super Mario, you know, 2.5, you know, it's just this IP. It's just like garbage. I mean, it just all blurs together but it's just like, okay, well, yeah, let's get some people to recycle just brand, some IP.
Like,
just,
yeah, new, like,
intellectual property, I should say. But exactly. It's just a big cardboard nothing. Mm-hmm. Or it's like watching movies, like picking from the candy store.
I compare them to like processed ham, you know, it's just like machine produces.
Yeah, you throw in a few quips,
yeah.
The big set piece action scene. Yeah, yeah. Some
A-listers,
extremely good-looking people, like serve it on a platter.
Yeah, I want a superhero movie with ugly people.
More slot, please.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in any case, what led to Villeneuve being able to develop to the point where he has this like very, I think he's known for his sort of visual, like real eye for stunning visuals.
Mm-hmm. I think people were surprised at how low the budget was for this film compared to like, because people talk about like Marvel movies are like budgets for like 300-400 million, right? And they look terrible because there's just kind of like overproduced, too much kind of green screen stuff. Where like Villeneuve here, a sign of his authorship, like you're saying, is able to create a beautiful looking movie for much less the cost.
He knows how to pick a director of photography as well.
Exactly.
But yeah, lots of practical effects, mm-hmm. lots of very tasteful, realistic-looking CGI, mm-hmm. Anyway, I could go into the movies more, but I won't because I want to talk about Denis Villeneuve and how he developed this style and what sort of gave him the opportunities. And so, yeah, if you contrast with someone like Christopher Nolan, who's like, you know, the son of like an advertising executive, mm-hmm. Basically, if you look at, you know, who funded his first film with Denis Villeneuve, it's like the National Film Board. It's like the publicly funded, you know, cultural institution that was an incredibly vital. It's sort of at the tail end of its vitality at the moment in the early 90s when Villeneuve was getting out of film school. But nonetheless,
it's still there.
And incredible. Yeah, it's still there. Mm-hmm. Has been on the decline, I would say. And certainly the people I've talked to say. But they funded Villeneuve's first film. He comes on the scene. Then he he makes a first feature. Then he actually takes a bunch of time off. Has three kids, and apparently works in the ad biz where you can do 6 days of work, get paid very well.
Yes,
this is a thing that Quebec filmmakers apparently do.
Yes, I have my friends do that.
There you go.
Sometimes I get some gigs. It's nice.
There you go. So
confirmed. That's been fact checked.
So it's a combination of Quebec sort of commercial milieu, but also the social democratic milieu, which and also the sort of cultural ferment that he sort of gets dropped into when working at the NFB. He's, there's all through the 70s and 80s, you have these a really strong thread of feminist filmmakers, the first Quebecois woman to direct a feature film happened through the NFB, and she made a whole series of other films. Mm-hmm. And then you have, people like Alanis Abumsawin, Abenaki filmmaker who made these incredible documentaries about indigenous struggles all through the 80s. And Villeneuve would have shown up the year after Kanazadake, 270 Years of Resistance, mm-hmm. came out. Which is her sort of, I would say, her sort of capstone achievement as mm-hmm. in terms of cultural relevance. Mm-hmm. Although all their films are incredible. So Villeneuve is dropped into this and also has been deeply influenced by the sort of Quebec feminist movement. I think he's mentioned this directly, but I think this propensity to really center strong, complex, female characters, mm-hmm. Is really at the, is sort of his signature really. I mean, if you look at Arrival or Dune 2 for that matter, mm-hmm.
Sicario.
Yeah, Sicario. Etc. You have this real approach that really is not the sort of
industry standard.
So, yeah, certainly not a favorite of Christopher Nolan, for example.
Yeah.
Where Villeneuve is is backed up by all these social democratic institutions, Christopher Nolan just self-finances his first movie. And the sort of their career tracks proceed from there, but I think it's also just I think his moment in the 90s when there was all this support and there was also very cheap rent in Montreal, and so you could do a lot with a little when it comes to filmmaking. You don't mm-hmm. have to now the rent's 3-5 times higher, mm-hmm. And you have to work multiple jobs to put rent together. And so it's a totally different situation for, so especially working class filmmakers mm-hmm. who don't have some kind of, family support or whatever.
Of course. Which Nolan had, as you're saying.
Yeah. Well, in which Nolan was clearly that, his talent is undeniable, but
sort of mechanism that brought him up is incredibly private and not public, like Denis Villeneuve's.
Yeah. It's like Stephen Jay Gould said, it's like, I'm not worried about,
I love that quote.
The size of and shape of Einstein's brain, mm-hmm. but all the people who are geniuses who never got to develop their
working in sweatshops.
Yeah, who are working in sweatshops. And it's the same thing. I think Villeneuve, if he was coming up right now, would he might make it to Hollywood somehow. Mm-hmm. But would he have developed this voice that's inflected by anti-colonial movements, mm-hmm. by feminist movements, by working, by a whole tradition of working class filmmaking, mm-hmm. Even though he's middle class, these are all his influences that he's sort of bringing with him to the, top of the international
elevate
stage
him.
Now. Yeah. It's an interesting sort of portrait of, I think, what has been, in terms of, of the vitality, how to create a vital cultural sort of moment, and also what could be, because these policies aren't that expensive. The National Film Board apparently is a sort of top heavy bureaucratic mess. It's been cut you know, by my rough calculations, it's been cut by like 25% if you adjust for 2024 dollars. If you adjust for inflation, it's been cut by about 25% since the 90s. But the decline of its relevance is the real main story.
Would you say that the cuts to the NFB, this sort of much more challenging, I guess, public funding for a cultural funding model right now, do you think that makes for a more difficult time to find the Denis Villeneuve that exists right now?
Yeah, I just think it's less likely that they emerge. You know, they just have to be that much more driven and passionate and dedicated and willing to like stretch themselves.
Use their parents' money.
Yeah, or use their parents' money. But that's, you know, that's narrowing significantly the pool of people that may or may not be talented. And so, yeah, there's been studies done in the UK where they say like, yeah, the number of like people of working class origin who are in the artistic world, basically writers, filmmakers, actors, musicians, has declined. Has been cut in half basically in the last like couple decades. And it's down to like 7.5%. And of course the working class is the vast majority of people who live in the UK, but they're only 7.5% of artists, you know, working artists.
And then that in turn gets reflected in the art that's made as well. A certain perspective is shown that's not usually a working class one.
Yeah. So just on a statistical level, you're getting less talent because you're only selecting from the smaller pool of people who have, you know, parental support or industry connections or whatever it is that gets them in the door and gets them doing the thing. But then you also, you also don't get that the range of human experiences and the societal relevance, frankly, is much lower because, you know, you're just talking about you're much more likely to see a film talking about the sort of like, I don't know, exploring the emotional foibles and petty obsessions of upper class, you know, rich kids than you are to have something that's deeply resonant on a social as well as psychological level. Maybe you still get the psychology, but it's still constrained, I think, by that class position.
Because at one end you have like a movie like I, Daniel Blake, and then at the other end you have like something like, I don't know, Love, Simon. Have you seen those?
I confess I haven't seen the latter, so I don't know.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean you're not reaching and you're not resonating. I think art's not resonating as much as a result.
So I guess it's an interesting point. I guess you bring up that Villeneuve had like sort of like this really rich, fertile kind of like these public institutions, right, that supported his sort of ascension and also his talent, right?
And supported all the people around him influenced him,
Because a film is, of course, not one, not just one person, but like the whole crew. Oh, his influences, yes, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Well, his influences, but also like you just said, a film is a giant team. And when you assemble like a team that's aligned and has vital debates and is really engaged with ideas on the sort of fundamental level, like, yeah, of course it's going to be a better film probably, you know, like that's, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I remember what I wanted to say about Denis Coderre.
Bring it.
One time I was working as a wedding videographer for this awful man whose name I will not say. I almost said it.
It's hard.
It was the wedding of this. It was like the wedding of the niece of the guy who owns the most Canadian tires in Quebec.
Don't say it.
I don't know who, but I just that's sort of all I remember. And so this is like happening at like Celine Dion's golf course.
Nice.
And there's like a bunch of whispers. They're like, I think she's gonna be here. She wasn't. But then Denis Coderre shows up. during the reception, he shows up. Shake some hands, make some speeches, and then he was out of there. And that's my one experience with Denis Coderre in person.
Yeah, I mean, he described himself like that. He's like, yeah, I like people. I like, you know, he likes to get in there and mix it up. And then, you know, it's
he was efficient.
I mean, you have to love it. You know, if you're in that situation.
On that note,
yeah, I was going to get into Denis Coderre and the like destruction of Haiti's democracy, but maybe for another time.
That's another episode. That's another 2 hours. thank you so much, Drew, for coming on, sharing your opinions, your takes on these issues. I think what you painted about the sort of public institutions that supported Villeneuve, and as well as his influence, I think is going to stay with me. So thank you for that.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. That's our show today, folks. No hello, goodbye lines today. Only goodbye, but bylines. I don't think that works as much as I thought it would. Take care of yourselves. Thank you for listening. Thank you to the crew here. And have yourselves a wonderful week.